Okay, 2 Chronicles 33. And we're almost to the end of Judah. Now we finished off Israel. They went off into captivity to Assyria. And now we're winding down to the last few kings of Judah. And so 2 Chronicles 33. And last 2 weeks we were talking about Hezekiah. And he was one of the best kings of Judah, right? And he was one that started off kind of weak in the faith, we could say, a little bit immature, not knowing how to really trust and follow God. He had a little bit of a run-in with some pride, and because of him trusting in his flesh instead of trusting in God and trusting in the wrong things, he had sickness, but that turned his heart to God, humbled him, and he recovered. He still had his little fault in showing the Babylonians all of his stuff and taking their interest in his kingdom as if it was some great thing rather than it actually being a them scouting him out. And so anyway, those were some problems. But after all of that, he turned to the Lord. He brought great revival. He trusted God for the deliverance from the Assyrians. God wiped out 180-some thousand Assyrians in one night. Without them even having to go to war after. So God brought about a lot of great things whenever Hezekiah matured, when he humbled, whenever he mellowed out maybe, and allowed God to take the lead. God brought about great things. But one thing that came about all of that was his son Manasseh, and that's what we're going to be looking at tonight. And Lydia kind of already gave us a little bit of a rundown on it before we started, but we're going to be looking at him and see what happened with him, because we're going to go from one of the greatest kings of Judah to the worst king of Judah, back to back. And that's kind of confusing, right? How could one of the most godly kings father one of the most ungodly kings, right? And so that's what we're going to be looking at tonight. And so 2 Chronicles chapter 33, and it also tells a little bit about him in 2 Kings 21. We may or may not look at that tonight. But anyway, starting in verse number 1 of 2 Chronicles 33, it says, Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, but did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, like unto the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. For he built again the high places which Hezekiah his father had broken down, and he reared up altars for Balaam, and made groves, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served them. Also he built altars in the house of the Lord, whereof the Lord had said, In Jerusalem shall my name be forever. And he built altars for all the host of heaven, in the two courts of the house of the Lord. And he caused his children to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. Also he observed times, and used enchantments, and used witchcraft, and dealt with familiar spirit, and with wizards, and he wrought much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. And he set a carved image, the idol which he had made, in the house of God, of which God had said to David and to Solomon his son, In this house and in Jerusalem which I have chosen before all the tribes of Israel will I put my name forever. Neither will I any more remove my foot of remove the foot of Israel out of the land which I have appointed for your fathers, so that they will take heed to all that I have commanded them, according to the whole law and the statutes and the ordinances, by the hand of Moses. So Manasseh made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to err and to do worse than all the heathen whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. And the Lord spake to Manasseh and to his people, but they would not hearken. And so anyway, as we were going to be looking at Manasseh, I said at the beginning that the question is, how could one of the most godly kings produce one of the most wicked ones? And that is a bit of a hard pill for us to swallow, isn't it? Because with Hezekiah, in all that he did, it says that there was no one who served God like he did before or after, right? That he was the one that sought after the Lord above any of them of the entire divided kingdom. And so that's a great compliment to him, right? And so Hezekiah was an extremely godly man. But then whenever we come to Manasseh, we look at the evil kings of Israel and Judah, and who are they generally compared with? Whenever we have an evil king, whenever we have a good one, we have him compared with David, right? He did that which was right according to all that David, his father, did and erred not to the right. But who do they compare the evil kings to? Yeah. Ahab's one of them that they compare him to, right? Yeah. Ahab and Jeroboam was two of the worst ones, right? And so Jeroboam was the one who introduced idol worship, but it was still idols of God, right? Ahab was the one that introduced idol worship and Baal worship, right? And so Ahab would have been a worse measure than Jeroboam. But whenever we come to Manasseh, who do they compare him with? The Canaanites, right? They had to go back before Israel was ever even in the land and said that he did so wickedly that he was following after and actually was worse than the people that God had ran out of the land in order to give it to Israel. So that's pretty bad. Because in the Bible we find that whenever God made the promise to Abraham, he says that they're going to be carried away for a time. It's going to be a while before they take possession of the land because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full, right? And so whenever they came and took possession of the land, that means that the iniquity of the Amorites had gotten to fullness, correct? And so with that line of thinking, comparing to the Amorites were so wicked that God had no choice but to run them out of the land and give it to Israel. And now Manasseh, as he is leading God's people, is exceeding the wickedness of the Amorites. So does that put it into perspective how wicked Manasseh is? I mean, more wicked than the ones that God ran out, the ones that he destroyed, the ones that he disinherited from the land in order to give it to Israel. And now Manasseh is exceeding them. So he's an extremely wicked guy, but he is the son of a very godly father. And so I was thinking on this for just a little while, and we don't have any concrete answers from the Bible of why this happens. But if we just look a little bit about the way that things work in different cases in the Bible, as well as just in life in general that we have seen, we can get a little bit of an idea of why this could have happened, right? So anyway, whenever we look at this passage and kind of think about this a little bit, one of the questions that was asked last week was about when Manasseh began to reign. And it says in the first verse that we read, Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign. Okay? 12-year-old king, right? But in what we've looked at, it appears that Manasseh was co-regent with Hezekiah. That as Hezekiah had his illness, had these different things that went about, that he realized he wasn't going to live forever, that apparently he brought his son along beside of him at 12 years old and allowed him to kind of start learning, being his apprentice, learning from Hezekiah. Because many of the places that I've read, many of the scholars that I've read, has said that Manasseh began to reign 10 years before Hezekiah died. So Hezekiah got an extra 15 years. He reigned for 5 years, then brought Manasseh in at 12 years old, began to reign with him. Okay? That would be a smart thing as a king to bring your heir along beside of you, and especially whenever he knows he's only got 15 years left, right? And as a king and as a good king, as a godly king, he's going to want to be an example to his son. He's going to want to instruct his son and help him to be a good king whenever he becomes a king, right? So at 12 years old, he begins to reign with his father, reigns with him for 10 years, and then at 22 years old, Hezekiah dies, and Manasseh begins to fully reign by himself. Okay, the reason I go into all of this, think about the ages that we're talking about. This is the ages that you guys have been through, right? Or that you're working on at the moment. And so you can kind of think about what's going on throughout the teenage years of different people, of people that we've looked at. And teenage years are known for being rebellious, aren't they? Is that what we see in society? Is that what we see in movies and television, which I know those aren't accurate portrayals, but is that not the time whenever they think they know it all? And so we put it this way. Hezekiah is raising his son. Hezekiah has went through a time of great humbling, yet he is an extremely powerful man in the kingdom. Okay, so from Manasseh's point of view, Hezekiah is the most powerful man in the kingdom, but yet he is a humble man. And he is relying upon God, he is trusting in God, and he is caring for the people, and he is not exercising his kingship to the fullness of its ability. Correct? We can see this in Rehoboam, though Rehoboam was like 40-something whenever he became king, right? But as Hezekiah is trying to instruct Manasseh and trying to teach him how to be a servant leader, a godly leader, how to trust God and to be humble, walking before God and obeying God, that probably won't resonate very well with teenage Manasseh. Because as a king, as a teenager, he's going to have the ideas that a king should be ruling. A king should be reigning, a king should be in charge, he should be respected, he should be feared, he should be all of these different things, right? And so I wonder if Manasseh didn't observe Hezekiah and his humble walk with God, and if he was offended by that, thinking, my old man doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He is such a weak king. He's such a weak ruler. He's using this God as a crutch. And I believe that I could become a greater ruler, a greater king, a more powerful king if I start doing these other things, if I start following the ways of the kings around me, if I start following after these gods that appeal to my flesh more than a God that tells me to be humble and obedient. Right? Because for a king, a God that tells you to be humble and obedient is not going to be the one you want to follow. And so anyway, I imagine those 10 years that he was with Hezekiah, that there were these thoughts. And you know, another thing to add into this is they are ruling over God's people. They are of the house and the lineage of David. They are in the genealogy of Jesus Christ, right? So what extra thing do they have against them? They have Satan. And would Satan not also be whispering in his ear? Would Satan not also be doing like he did with Eve back in the garden and causing him to question the authorities that are over him, causing him to question the things that are going on about him? And so throughout this time, he is getting these thoughts and these ideas of how the kingdom should be, and whenever I have a chance to be king. And so the thought that just came to my mind as I was saying that, you all laugh at me for this, but think about Simba in The Lion King. Whenever he is young, and he's observing his dad, and he's observing the way that his dad's doing things, and he says, whenever I become a king, I'm going to be a mighty king, everyone beware, right? You got the whole song? And I can imagine that Manasseh would have been just like that. That he would have been observing his wise and godly father. Not saying that Mufasa was. But anyway, observing his wise and godly father and saying he doesn't have a clue what he's doing. He's doing all of this wrong. He doesn't know what he's doing in any of these things. And this is the way that a lot of teenagers go about it. They observe their parents and their parents don't know what they're talking about. They go off to university, and as they're listening to their professors and they're listening to all these different ones that's expounding on all these worldly, fleshly ideas, and they become ashamed of their parents almost because their parents are foolish, their parents are unlearned, their parents are stupid, and maybe one of these days they'll get smarter. But what ends up happening a lot of times is after they get out of their little bubble and after they get out of their university courses and whatnot, and they have to get jobs, they have to pay bills, they have a health scare or two, they get into an accident, they have to pay taxes. They have all these different life experiences that come against them. They learn the hard way, and all of a sudden, their parents weren't so stupid after all. They start to learn these things. And so it's amazing how their parents finally wise up after all those years, huh? And so I have a feeling this is what was going on with Manasseh and Hezekiah. Okay? And so Manasseh was sitting there being critical. He was sitting there questioning. He was sitting there formulating. And then whenever Hezekiah passes off the scene, he says, now's my hour to shine. Now's my time to show what I'm made of. And he begins to implement all of these changes. He begins to allow all of these things in that Hezekiah had gotten rid of. He starts listening to all of the crowds where Hezekiah has done away with their gods and their idols and their altars and all of these things. And they start saying, hey, we used to worship this God here and we used to worship this God here. He says, bring him in. And he starts doing things and his popularity begins to rise. People get excited about it because he's doing what the crowds want him to do. He is pandering to this one and that one. He becomes a politician, right? And all of a sudden, it's anything goes, whatever makes the people happy, whatever he makes him popular. But he becomes popular with man, but he's not popular with God. And this is what ends up happening, I believe, in this situation. The Bible doesn't give us a whole lot of insight into this, but how does a godly king have such a wicked son? I don't believe we can blame it on Hezekiah, right? I don't believe we can. I don't find any evidence anywhere where Hezekiah was just such a lousy father that Manasseh went haywire. Especially whenever we find that Hezekiah walked with God, he led these reforms throughout all the kingdom, and he even brought his son up to be a co-regent with him. He didn't just send him away, delegate him to delegate his mom or whoever to raise him, but he brought him in and was raising him alongside, was teaching and was training him, right? He was involved. And so anyway, Manasseh had an extremely good example we see in this, but for whatever reason, he chose to follow all the bad ones, right? One thing I find interesting in the record of this in 2 Kings 21, it records his mother's name, okay? And now I'm not going to blame everything on the mother. I figure maybe I ought to say that. But in 2 Kings 21, this is something that I've been watching as I've been reading through and been teaching through this series. But 2 Kings 21, Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign and reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hephzibah. Okay? And the reason I'm pointing this out is on these times whenever there is a godly king that begets a wicked son or a wicked king that begets a godly son, I see a trend of it mentioning the mother. Now, there's a lot of the kings that we've looked at, there's no mention of the mother whatsoever. But it seems like it's the ones where there is a great difference between the father and the son that the mother is mentioned. So what would be the significance of that? Yeah. Who you marry makes a huge difference, doesn't it? Because it's very possible that it was the influence of the mother that influenced the child, right? And we've even seen in the case of Ahab, Ahab was a follower, wasn't he? Yeah. If Ahab would have married a godly woman, he may have been one of the most godly kings. But he married a wicked woman and ended up becoming one of the most wicked kings because he did whatever Jezebel told him to. And so the wife made a huge difference. And so this very well could be what happened with Manasseh, is it could be the influence of his mother upon him. So it could have been the influence of his mother. It could have been just his rebellious years catching up with him, all these different thoughts. We also find different stories in Scripture that go along with this idea. We find the story of the prodigal son. Okay? And it was the Lord that told about the prodigal, right? And with as much as Jesus knows, I don't believe that he had to make up a story. Even though we have a lot of parables, I believe that a lot of the parables were based on true things that he knew about as God, that he's experienced, that he had seen happen. And so it's very possible that he was aware of a situation where a father had two sons and one of them stayed home and one went away. Okay? And so Manasseh very much was the prodigal son. And so whenever Hezekiah died, Manasseh had full reign over all of the kingdom, and he began to do that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, like the abomination of all of the heathen that was before. And in this, we see kind of an outline of the way a carnal or a wicked society goes. Okay? If we just kind of look at these next few verses and see what all happens in this, we find that one thing that he did is that in verse 3, he built the things that Hezekiah had broken down. Hezekiah had done great work. He had put lots of effort in to reforms, to revival, to getting rid of all of the wicked influences. And so what did Manasseh do? Undid everything that Hezekiah had done. And in society, what we end up finding out that happens is that as people get further and further away from God, one of the first things they do is bring in all the things that previous generations worked so hard against. Okay? All of the things that were prized, all of the things that were important to previous generations, all of a sudden are rubbish. And all the things that were rubbish to previous generations now are prized. And as we look at the things that are going on in society today, the different things that's going on with all of these movements, all of the homosexuality and the transgenderism and feminism and all of this, these go absolutely opposite to previous generations' values, right? And so he adopted all of the values that were opposite of the previous generation. Whatever the previous generation saw as virtue, they saw as vice. And vice versa, right? And this is what's going on here. And it's like an overreaction. Whenever they said, whatever they did, I want to do the opposite. And so they see everything that the previous generation was doing as evil. And that's what was going on there. He said, Hezekiah got rid of all these things. I'm bringing them back. Hezekiah said, these were bad. I'm going to say that they're good. Bible says, woe to him that calls good evil and evil good, right? And this is what was going on in Manasseh's time. We also find that they worship false gods and creation. It talks about how they worshiped Baal, how they worshiped all the hosts of heavens and served them. Now, it talks about all the hosts of heavens. It was talking about all the sun, the moon, the stars, the astrology, and all of the we see in ancient worship, and sun, moon worship, all of that is where we get all of the astrology of today and the zodiac and the horoscopes and how they believe that the stars and the planets affect our lives because it's like worshiping it. It's things that we have today, right? Not only that, but they're worshiping the creature above the creator, the creation above the creator, and it's almost this Mother Earth type philosophy that he was bringing in, which we're seeing today as well. And so they worship false gods. They worship the creation. Verse 6, they had no respect for life. He calls his children to pass through the fire in the valley of Hinnom. And so this would have been Molech worship. This would have been child sacrifice. He was killing his own children. How quickly they devolve, right? And so there's no value for human life, no sanctity of life. You see all these things going on in society? Okay. And then in the second half of verse 6, it says they observed times, used enchantments, used witchcraft, dealt with familiar spirits, with wizards, and he wrought much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. So Manasseh was extremely spiritual, wasn't he? But it was the wrong kind of spirit. And so this is one of the things that humanity falls into, is mankind is extremely spiritual. There is a spiritual hunger, a spiritual craving, but whenever they are away from God and whenever they are walking in darkness, they end up kind of drifting toward the occult. They are hungering after something spiritual, but they are ending up with the wrong kind of spirit. It's one reason why the Bible tells us that we are to try the spirits. That doesn't mean to, like a taste test, which one's better. But it's figuring out what spirit am I following after, because our soul, our spirit does crave that spiritual fellowship. But if we're not getting it with God, we end up getting it with Satan. And so in the place which we live here, there are plenty of people who are in witchcraft. there are plenty of people into Satanism. There's plenty of people into the occult and spiritism. There's plenty of people who have no problem with familiar spirits and wizards and seances and palm reading and tarot cards and all these different things. And it's all this stuff that Manasseh got into. Still alive and well today. I was looking in the waiting room over here, and there was a current magazine with this whole Eurovision mess. And this one that went to Eurovision, their goal is to turn everyone away from God and turn them to the devil. They said that. They want them to worship, or get started and interested in witchcraft. Okay? And so the magazine that's in the waiting room over there, it talks about that individual, but it talks about a rise of witchcraft in Ireland, if that wasn't already a big enough thing. Okay? And so whenever they turn away from God, they pursue after all of the things that the previous generations, those who did serve God, said were evil. They start pursuing after them. They worship false gods in creation. They have no respect for life. They go after the wrong kind of spiritual. And then in verse number 7, it says that he set a carved image of the idol which he had made in the house of God. So now there is a mixture here going on between idols and God, the things of the devil and the things of God. This syncretism, mixing together of two different religions, right? And so what we find today, this is going on in churches and religion all throughout, where they're trying to mix worldliness with Christianity, where they're trying to mix the things of God with the things of the devil, where they're trying to bring these things together and make them more attractive, more palatable, more pleasing to the flesh. And this is what Manasseh was doing. He says, okay, we've got the temple, we've got the altar, but we've also got this idol that I have made, that I have carved out, that I've done. And so they brought all of these things together. And so he is just piling on every offense that he can to offend God. At the end of this, it said that, end of verse 6, to provoke the Lord to anger. And then in verses 7 and 8, he thought he could have a success outside of the obedience to God. In verse 7 and 8, it brings out God's promise to the house of David, to the people of Judah, and how they would continue to live in the land, how they would continue to have a king before them as long as they walked with God and served him. And basically, Manasseh says, forget all of that. Forget the promises of God. Forget the plan of God. Forget all the things that he's laid out. I'm going to do it all my own way. And I think I'll get along just fine doing it my way. I don't need God's promises. I don't need his plan. I don't need his protection. I'm going to do it my way and I'll prosper anyway. That was his idea. But you can't live contrary to God's will and God's plan successfully. And Manasseh figures that out. And so whenever we come down to verses 9 and 10, where we finished at, it says, Manasseh made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to err and to do worse than the heathen, which the Lord destroyed before the children of Israel. And the Lord spake to Manasseh and to his people, but they would not hearken. So this carries out. Manasseh introduces all these things in. He goes completely the wrong way. He goes full tilt the wrong direction. And as he's going, he takes everyone else with him. We don't sin in, what's the word I'm looking for here? We don't sin by ourselves. We are not isolated in our sin. And so his sin passed on to others, and they all refused to be corrected. Whenever it says here that the Lord spake to Manasseh, the Jewish Talmud has recorded that Manasseh is the one that killed Isaiah the prophet. Okay? Remember, Isaiah came to Hezekiah. Hezekiah and Isaiah, they were like a dynamic duo there leading the people. Well, Isaiah outlived Hezekiah, and he came and was preaching to Manasseh. He was preaching to Hezekiah's son, trying to call him back to the ways of his father. And Manasseh basically said, you crazy old man, I'll teach you to talk to me that way. And history tells us that How it happened, I don't know. Somehow Isaiah ended up in the middle of a hollow log and was sawed in half. So whenever you're reading the book of Hebrews, it talks about him being sawn asunder in the Old Testament. That's referring to Isaiah's death under the hand of Manasseh. So if you haven't already found out by now, we hate Manasseh. Look at all the things that he's done. Look at how wicked, look at how far and how depraved he became whenever he turned away from the example that was set before him and the way that God had challenged him to go, whenever he ignored all the things of godly influences and ran headlong into wickedness. And there is no end. Whenever you begin down that road, there is no end because you can go much further than you ever intend to go. And that's where Manasseh ended up at. But he thought he would be okay at it. And so whenever we consider a little bit more about Manasseh and how he ended up this way, another thing that I want to bring out in this, because this saying came to my mind whenever I was studying this out, but because of Hezekiah's godliness, because of the way that he led the people of Judah, because of the way that he had served God, God had blessed Hezekiah and the people of Judah, right? They destroyed the Assyrians. They had peace in the land. Things were going well in Judah whenever Hezekiah was reigning, when Manasseh was reigning along with him, and whenever Manasseh inherited the kingdom, things were going well in the kingdom, right? But why were things going well? Because Hezekiah had learned to humble himself, follow God, and trust in God, right? And so the saying that came to my mind, and I want to know if you guys had ever heard this, but the saying is, hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. And weak men create bad times. Yeah. And the cycle continues. Okay, the reason I bring all of this out is that there were strong men that created good times. And Manasseh inherited the kingdom during good times, and he was inherently a weak man, which brought about bad times. Okay? And so the reason I'm bringing this out is that whenever things are going well, when everything is going dandy, whenever the generations before have fought the battles, when the generations before have went through the struggles, and they have earned the peace, and they had earned the prosperity, then the generation that follows, that's never had to fight, that doesn't know what it's like to struggle, they end up taking it for granted, and then they get into all kinds of nonsense, and then they bring about all kinds of corruption and wickedness. And so I relate that once again to the society which we're in, and we're at this place where we are a society filled with weak men that are feasting off of the good times of the previous generations that are getting ready to bring about bad times. It's going to require good men, strong men, to correct it, right? Isn't that what happens? And so I think one of the reasons why there is such a tendency to wickedness, why there's so much of this depravity that's going on in the cultures that we're in, is things have been good for too long. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I want bad times. I'm saying I want strong men.
Yeah.
But the problem is, you don't have strong men in good times.
Yeah.
And so that's where we're at right now. And so why is God not a priority? Why are people not interested in church? Why are people not interested in serving him? Why are people becoming so depraved? Because people have had it easy for a long time. And they don't realize that it is all the blessings of God and the struggles of those who have fought before. And throughout all of this, they're making a mess. Another thing with Manasseh inheriting this kingdom from Hezekiah, how often is it whenever a man labors, starts, works his way up from the bottom, maybe he starts out broke and destitute and poor, he puts all of his time, his effort, his money, everything in to building a business, building an empire. He gets it running like clockwork. He gets everything smooth. He builds an empire up. He has great wealth, and he passes away. His children inherit it. What do they do? easy come, easy go, right? And very few times does someone inherit wealth and use it wisely. And so we've looked at several different reasons why it's possible that Manasseh had the outcome that he did, right?
Yeah.
I think his thought life, as he was being raised up under his father, and as he had this power thrust upon him at this point in time, I think that's part of the reason. I think maybe some of the influences of his family and of the community around him, I think that's part of the reason. Some of it is that he was raised up in a time of prosperity, in a time of luxury, and he didn't know how to be a strong man or a good man. And I think that could have been part of it. And he didn't know what it was like to struggle or to work or to stress. And that was part of it. But whatever it was, if it was all of these things or one of these things or something else completely, he had everything that he needed. He had access. He had seen God heal his father. He had seen God defeat the Assyrians. He had heard all the stories of how God had worked with the children of Israel. He had seen the northern kingdom carried away captive, right? Heard about those things. And yet, whenever it came his time to rule, he squandered all those things. He made all the wrong decisions. He brought about all these things and did all that he could to mislead his people and to offend his God. And so, if you were God, what would you do? Good time for a well-aimed lightning bolt?
Yeah.
But what we find is instead of that, picking up where we left off at, wherefore the Lord brought upon him, verse 11, upon them, the captains of the host of the king of Assyria, which took Manasseh among the thorns, and bound him with fetters, and carried him to Babylon. And when he was in affliction, he besought the Lord his God, and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers, and prayed to him. And he was entreated of him, and heard his supplication, and brought him again to Jerusalem, into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord, he was God. So Manasseh has a Nebuchadnezzar event, right? He gets humbled. He gets taken from his throne, and instead of running like a wild beast, he is imprisoned in Babylon. He comes to his senses after being humbled, calls out to God, and God restores him to his kingdom. Right? So that's what ends up happening. God's love and his mercy and his justice all work together to bring about chastisement in his life. Rather than just throwing a lightning bolt and striking him dead, he says, I've got better ideas for Manasseh. It's time for reformation. It's time to get his attention. It's time to humble him a little bit rather than to destroy him. So God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but he does desire that all men be saved. He decides to put Manasseh through situations that's going to turn his heart to God so that he'll get right with him. And it works. And so he allows the Assyrians to come up, carry him away captive. It says here that took him among the thorns and carried him with fetters. Now, the idea of taking him among the thorns could be one of two things. Either in a way of punishing him, they drug him through the thorns. That's what they would do sometimes. If you've ever been caught up in a briar patch, I think we all have been. It's not a pleasant thing. Could you imagine being drugged through a briar patch? Have your flesh ripped from you a little bit? That would be humbling, wouldn't it? Okay. So it was either that or that Manasseh was cowering and hiding amongst the thorns, and they had to go and take him out of hiding. So it's one way or the other, and probably even if he was hiding amongst the thorns, they probably still drug him through them. Mm-hmm. Okay? So he learned pain. He learned humiliation. He learned suffering. He learned bondage. He was carried away to Babylon, bound with fetters. I believe it's in 2 Kings where it talks about it, that he's going to be as a bull, basically, with a hook in his nose. You ever see him lead a bull around by the bull ring? And I didn't write it down. Anyway. I don't see it there. But anyway, he was carried away captive into Babylon. And while he was there, all of the teachings of his father, all of the lessons that he learned whenever he was younger, all of those things that were once foolishness and nonsense to him began to make sense. This is kind of along the lines of training up a child in the way he should go. Whenever he's old, he'll not depart from it. The idea behind that is that it's not going to depart from him. It's going to hang with him for a while. And so the hope is that they're going to return to it. And so whenever Manasseh got in this place where he was humbled, where he had nowhere else to turn, kind of like Hezekiah, whenever he was sick on his back and told he's going to die, he turned to God. He didn't turn to his idols. He didn't turn to golden cows. He didn't turn to Molech or Balaam or any of these. He turned to the God of Israel. Because at that time, he realizes the rest of it was nonsense, the rest of it was foolishness. And whenever he turned to God, it says that he was entreated of him. He was heard. God listened to the prayer of someone so ruthless and so wicked that sacrificed their children to idols, that sawed the prophet in half, right? That led God's people into idolatry, that undid all the reforms and revivals. Someone so wicked, someone so horrible, that whenever he went and he finally humbled himself, he finally cried out to God and God heard him. Just like Jonah in the belly of the well. Right? And so many other stories that we hear. And he cried out to God, humbled himself, cried out to God. God heard him. And not only did God hear him and say, okay, well, I'm going to save you. It'll be okay. You'll go to heaven, but for right now, you're going to be dispatched in a horrible way. He says, let me just show you how much of God I am. I'm going to restore you to your previous position. And so it says that Manasseh reigned for 55 years, right? There's no break in that. Manasseh reigned even through captivity. He was still considered the king. The kingdom was sure to him, and he returned to his throne. Now, if we just think about this logically, we watched the Assyrians carry off our king to Babylon. Next. And so here's the thought behind this. In the beginning, as we're looking at Manasseh's life, folks would have looked at him and said he was a lost cause. He's too wicked. He's too against God, too anti-God, right? He wants nothing to do with God. He is past saving. There is no way that God could ever do anything with Manasseh, right? Then whenever he gets to Babylon, folks would have said he's a lost cause. He's broken. He's in failure. He's in bondage in Babylon. He got what he deserved. There's nothing more for him. But then whenever God got a hold of him and dealt with him and humbled him, he restored him, and then he blessed him. Put him back on the throne and allowed him to rule again at the end of this. And so this is a powerful statement to show that no matter how broken, how messed up, how much of a lost cause someone is, that God can still do something with them. He can still restore them. He can still make something out of them, right? And he does. And so whenever we come down to verse number 14, we find it says, now after this, he built a wall without the city of David and on the west side of Gihon in the valley, even to the entering of the fish gate, and compassed about Ophel, and raised it up a very great height, and put captains of war in all the fenced cities of Judah. It seems at the beginning of Manasseh's reign that he was only concerned about doing wickedness, right? But now that he's returned, he's got a new lease on life, he's got a new purpose, and he's setting out to make reforms in Judah that's going to protect the people. He is looking out for those he is ruling over. Before he went into Babylon, he was following his heart.
Right.
But now he's allowing God to have his heart, and God is leading him to shepherd the people and protect the people. There's a change that took place, isn't there? Then whenever we come down to verse number 15, it says, he took away the strange gods and the idol out of the house of the Lord, and all the altars he had built in the mount of the house of the Lord, and in Jerusalem, and cast them out of the city. So now the next thing he's doing is he is seeking to cleanse the city. He's seeking to make amends. He's taking away all of the wicked things that he had brought in, right? So he was watching out to protect the people. Now he's trying to cleanse the land. In verse 16, he's restoring worship. He repaired the altar of the Lord and sacrificed their own peace offerings and thank offerings and commanded Judah to serve the Lord, the God of Israel. So he decided he wanted to protect the people. He wanted to cleanse the land. He wanted to restore worship. He's doing well. This is a huge revival. This is a huge turnaround from Manasseh in the beginning to Manasseh at the end. Right? I do wonder how this worked out time-wise. The 55 years, we know the first 10 years of it, he was co-regent. Still has 45 years left. How old was he whenever he was carried away? I wonder. We don't know, do we? We don't know how many good years he had at the end. And the Bible doesn't say. So I guess we don't really need to know. But when we come down to verse number 17, what's the first word of verse 17? Nevertheless. So he's making these reforms. He's had a change of heart. He's like Scrooge on Christmas. Yeah, Christmas Carol. On the morning after he meets with the three ghosts, he's a changed man. He's turning everything around, right? And so this is what Manasseh is doing. He's turning everything around. Nevertheless. That's another word for nevertheless. But. Nevertheless, the people did sacrifice still in the high places, yet unto the Lord their God only. And so he brought all of these things in that Hezekiah had done away with. And now at the end of this, he has changed. He has been revived. He has been restored. But there's still lingering effects on the people around him. He couldn't erase the effect that his sin and the wickedness that he had on other people. Remember I said that God can take the most messed up, the most broken, all the mistakes. He can take all those things and bring about revival and restoration. But there are still consequences that can't be erased. And so the effects that he had on those that he loved and on the people around him, on the people he was serving, they were still there, still lingered. And then whenever we come down to verse 18 through 20, now the rest of the acts of Manasseh and his prayer unto the God and the words of the seers that spake to him in the time of the Lord God of Israel, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel, his prayer also and how God was entreated of him and all his sins and his trespass and the places whereon he built high places and set groves and graven images before he was humbled. Behold, they are written among the sayings of the seers. So Manasseh slept with his fathers, and they buried him in his own house, and Amnon, his son, reigned in his stead. And so he couldn't erase the effects on others, and he also couldn't erase his past. His past marred history's record of him. Even as we talked about this before we began, the memory that we had of Manasseh, he was a wicked king. Even while we're going to continue reading as we go on further in this, it is Manasseh and his wickedness that is credited with the downfall of Judah in the end. That because of all of the things during his extremely long reign, it led Judah to a place that was beyond repair to where they finally had to be carried off into Babylon. Because of the things that he had done. And so he couldn't erase his past. And it marred his reign completely. He wasn't known for his restoration. He wasn't known for the revival. He wasn't known for the work of God in him. He was known for his wickedness. And there's many people today, good, God-fearing people, people who are serving God, that their past haunts them the rest of their life. Everywhere they go, everywhere they turn, everybody they run into, they are constantly being reminded of what they used to be. And it can be a testimony for what God's able to do. Whenever they say, hey, I remember when you did this and you did this. Yes, but God got a hold of me and he did all these things. Mm-hmm. It can be a testimony for God, but it's going to be something that's going to linger. It's going to stick around. And so you know that Manasseh had regrets. He had regrets. But as we're looking at the life of Manasseh and all of this, most of the kings that we have saw started out good and ended up evil. Right? They started out good, they ended up evil. Manasseh is the one that is different from all the rest in that he started off evil and he ended up good. It's pretty incredible, isn't it? Started off evil and ended up good. So God can turn around even the most vile sinners. But Manasseh is the outlier in this. He's one of the very few. And so anyway, With that, we see Manasseh. He's dead and he's buried in his own house. He's not buried with the rest of the kings, but he's buried in his own house, in his own garden there. And the very last section of this chapter is Manasseh's son. And we know very little about his son. He only reigns for 2 years, and he is known as being wicked. So Manasseh's reform doesn't reach his son. So let's go ahead and read this last little bit. We'll just take a minute at this. That's about all we need to devote to this guy. And then, Lord willing, next week we'll look at Josiah. But it says, Ammon was 2 and 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 2 years in Jerusalem. But he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, as did Manasseh his father. For Ammon sacrificed unto the carved images which Manasseh his father had made, and served them, and humbled not himself before the Lord, as Manasseh his father had humbled himself. But Ammon trespassed more and more, and his servants conspired against him, and slew him in his own house. But the people of the land slew all them that conspired against Ammon, and the people of the land made Josiah his son king in his stead. I think Ammon is a good possibility that he is a part of the effects of Manasseh's early life. Because just like with Hezekiah and Manasseh, we can't say necessarily what caused the disconnect between the two of them. But we find that Ammon was 22 whenever he began to reign. Manasseh had reigned for 55 years, 45 by himself, right? So if you take that, Ammon was alive about half of Manasseh's reign, right? And so if we consider the way that Ammon turned out, it's a good possibility that much of his early life and upbringing was under the wickedness of his father, right? And he was raised through his younger years, everything in idolatry and wickedness and all these different things. And then all of a sudden his father went through a traumatic experience, came back a different guy, and Ammon said, okay, glad that works for you, but I'm not buying into all of your religious stuff. I want to continue the way that I was. You think that's maybe what happened? Glad you went and found God, but I'm just going to continue on the way we're going. And that's what often happens whenever parents get saved later in life when their kids are already nearly raised or grown. And then the parents get saved and their kids are like, yeah, I'm not buying into it. That works for you. It's not working for me. That may be the case, but whatever it was, Ammon did not share in the revival that Manasseh had. And so Ammon did wickedly. He worshiped the idols. The idols that his dad had made, right? He worshiped them. He did wickedly, led the people in doing wickedly. And so he had a couple of the people from the land decided, we don't like this guy. We don't know if it was political. Most likely it was political, not religious. But they decided to kill Ammon. And he only reigned 2 years and died. 24 years old whenever he dies. Very young. And so he dies at 24 years old. And they bury him with his father, I believe. Slew him in his own house. I'm thinking it says in 2 Kings that he was buried with his father. But anyway, and that was the end of his son. And I think maybe it was his influence on him. But as we saw all of that, Hezekiah's influence didn't reach Manasseh. Maybe Manasseh's didn't reach his son. Maybe Ammon was just wicked because he was wicked. I don't know. But either way, he's basically a footnote in the story. We're going to have 5 minutes that we dedicate here to Ammon. And he's dead, buried, he's gone. And his son becomes king at 8 years old. That means that, just as a funny side note in this, how old was Ammon whenever he had Josiah? He died at 24 and his son was 8 years old. That's one of the younger ones we've seen in Scripture, isn't it? So anyway, Josiah would have been 8 whenever he began to reign. We'll look at him next week. So do y'all have anything to add to or Any comments?
16 years old?
Well, that was one thing about it, is perhaps Ammon was so busy in his aspirations and whatnot that Manasseh in his... See, Josiah wouldn't have known anything but Manasseh after his salvation, right? Ammon knew him before. Josiah only knew him after. And so it's possible that in that first 6 years of Josiah's life, that Manasseh had a positive impact on Josiah to bring about his God consciousness, right?
They're saying different phases in life, each kid get a different one. Ammon got his younger years. Josiah got his older years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's... Well, Ammon was the father and Josiah the son. So then Ammon would have been still very young from 16 to 22... 16 to 24. He would have been busy with all of his political aspirations and everything. And it's a good possibility that Josiah was just hanging out with Grandpa.
No.
And so that might have made... And this is speculation, but that might have been what ended up happening in Josiah's life. And so Manasseh's great revival may not have saved his son, but it may have made a huge impact on his grandson. Okay, well, let's go ahead and pray. Call it a night. Dear Lord, we come to you today. Just thank you for your blessings. Lord, we thank you for all of these characters that are recorded in Scripture that we can learn from, their mistakes and their victories both. And I know some of this has been speculation. Some of this has just been kind of analyzing the story tonight. But Lord, I just pray that you would help us to take these thoughts and apply them to our lives, and to keep us from making some of the very same mistakes that these guys did. And Lord, I just pray that we could humbly and faithfully follow you, allow you to work in our lives, Lord, not fall into the foolishness that some of these guys did. And Lord, we just thank you so much for all that you do, and we do love you and we praise you. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.